You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
A few housekeeping notes before we start today's episode. I'll be talking with Arianna Huffington for an upcoming webinar that will be all about our newest collaboration with her group, Thrive Global. If you're interested in watching, please send an email to events@thriveglobal.com. On Thursday, March 5th, I'll be hosting a live podcast taping with Katie Borum-Chatou and Lauren Feldman about their new book, A Comedian and an Activist Walk into a Bar. We'll be taping at the Second City, and you can sign up on the Facebook page for the Second City Training Center. Just click on the events link. And on March 19th, I'll be hosting a webinar titled Developing Leadership at Every Level, an Improvisational Approach. You can sign up by going to www.secondcityworks.com, click on the feed, and scroll down to find the link.
Before we start today's podcast, it's got some trigger warnings for you. We do talk about suicide. We talk about sexual assault, and we talk about trauma. We talk about rape. This is an expert academic in those fields. I think it's a really powerful conversation, but if any of those things you're not ready to hear them, maybe skip this podcast.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Jennifer Fried. Dr. Fried is Director of Project on Institutional Courage, founder of the Center for Institutional Courage, professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, visiting scholar at Stanford Medical School, and faculty affiliate of the VMware Women's Leadership Innovation Lab at Stanford University. She is nationally renowned expert on interpersonal and institutional betrayal trauma and sexual violence and discrimination within institutional settings. And she's currently building the Center for Institutional Courage, and that mission is equally split between research and outreach. The center will be nurturing new research on institutional courage and will be sharing that research in ways that promote its implementation in the world now. Jennifer Fried, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I can't imagine that you were plopped down in front of your TV watching the season finale of South Park, but someone who knew you, I'm guessing, was, right?
Yes, I woke up the morning after it was aired, and there were quite a few emails in my inbox saying, congratulations, you were on South Park last night, or DARPA was on South Park, whatever, and I was like, what?
All right, so let's for our listeners, we're going to play this clip, and then we're going to talk about this concept of DARVO.
What? Who? Okay, sure, put him through. This is the president.
Hi, Mr. President. I'm really sorry to bother you. Look, I'm in a bit of trouble.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah, someone got some supposed evidence on me doing something illegal.
Well, did you tell everyone you didn't do anything wrong?
Yeah, of course.
Well, did you then go on the attack and swap the accusations to make yourself a victim?
Did I what?
Oh, jeez. DARVO, Randy. Deny, attack, reverse victim, and offender. All right, let's role play. You be your accusers and I'll be you. Okay, go.
Hey, you blew up people's yards who were growing their own marijuana.
No, I didn't. Are you joking, psychopath? Now you're blowing up my yard. Go ahead, try another one.
You illegally damage property and make your business...
You damage property to make your business more profitable, you lying sack of shit! I'm not gonna be bullied by you! See? It's really not that hard. Just takes a little chin wiggle.
Jeez, you're really good at that. Look, what I really need from you is some personnel. Do you know any good lawyers?
Do I know any good lawyers? No, but I do know Rudy Giuliani. Hey, fuck you! The fuck you, Rudy? You finished cleaning up those pistachio nuts yet? Yeah, that's all of them, Mr. President. Listen, Randy, I'm going to throw you a bone.
You just sit tight and I'll help you take care of this.
All right, so this is, you know, I Darvo and South Park seem like very strange things to be put together, but break down this concept for us. And I think the clip actually did a pretty good job of it.
I do. I agree with you. I think it was quite well done. Well, DARVA is an acronym. It stands for deny, attack, and it's really attack the credibility of a person, and reverse victim and offender. And the idea of DARVA is it's a way to deflect blame. It's a perpetrator strategy or a strategy for people who are trying to protect somebody from being held accountable for some action. It's something I first began to think about and label a long time ago in the 90s, and one of the sources of inspiration was watching the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings and having the thought that Clarence Thomas's reaction was not what I would have expected from the former head of the EEOC. Let's say he was innocent or believed he was innocent. I would have thought he would have said something along the lines of, wow, I'm very concerned and disturbed to hear this. It doesn't match what I remember, but I need to understand where you're coming from. I do know how important it is to be able to talk openly about this matter and how difficult it is. Right. Sexual harassment is a problem in our society, and we need to address it when it's raised. To me, that would have been the appropriate response, but we got a really different response, one that involved these components of DARVO. He denied it. He attacks the credibility of the person making the claim, and then he put himself into the victim role, reversing victim and offender.
Yeah, and you must like wake up every morning and open the paper and be like, someone's doing this again in the political realm. This feels like DARVO on steroids.
Yes, and I think we're seeing more of it maybe in the last couple of years than a typical year. I mean, I think it's been there the whole time.
Right.
But it really was put forward very strongly by President Trump before he was elected, when he was a candidate, and he was accused of various actions, and he used a DARVO response. We saw it again with Kavanaugh. We've seen it with even Bill Clinton did it when asked in an interview within the last few years about his experiences back when he was the president and Monica Lewinsky. So it gets used over and over again. And one of the things I think that's made it so frequent recently is that it works.
Yeah.
And when you see very powerful men use it to their advantage, that's a pretty strong reinforcement for other people to do it.
So I was reading the paper you published in 2017 that you wrote with two colleagues, and there's just so many upsetting facts, right? So in your study, 59% denied ever committing the offense, 69% minimized the harm of their attacks, and you write in the paper that most perpetrators actually never face legal repercussions for their abusive actions. This seems just untenable and unbelievable, but it's true.
Yeah, and we also found that it has an effect on the victim, that when they receive a DARVO response, they're more likely to blame themselves for the event in the first place. And we know from other research that self-blame is associated with silence. It's an effective strategy. We did another study that's under review right now, several that are under review. We found we used something called a vignette approach. It allows us to do an experiment where we present vignettes that are very similar but vary slightly from condition to condition. And in this case, the vignettes described an act of interpersonal violence and varied whether the perpetrator responded to being held accountable with DARVO or not. And then we had people read these and judge how responsible was the perpetrator for what happened. Unfortunately, if the perpetrator in these vignettes used a Darvo response, our participants found the perpetrator less responsible for what happened. So again, it works. Wow. The good news is we did a study where we randomly and assigned people to be educated about Darvo or not. So we had half of our participants learned about Darvo as a concept and how to recognize it, and the other half had some other learning experience. Mm-hmm. The ones who learned about Darvo were less swayed by it, yeah, when they then came on to encounter it. And to me, that's really, really promising, because it means we can educate people and reduce its power.
Yeah, I was at a I might have mentioned this to an email exchange that we had, but with a team up at the University of Chicago that deals with bias on the campus, and they were talking very much about, you know, you're not going to necessarily change certain kinds of behavior bias, but we also don't, not everyone has the knowledge, and sometimes when you have the knowledge of the various things that are going on, you are more apt to be able to call it out in the moment, and that seems like a tool that would be very useful today.
Yes, I do believe so.
You wrote a book, Blind to Betrayal, and I hadn't heard this term, betrayal blindness. And you write in the book that it means not seeing what is there to be seen. Talk to us about what that means.
Yeah, well, and it's not seeing a particular aspect of the world, which is that you're being betrayed or that betrayal is happening in your midst. So betrayal blindness is a concept that grew out of a theory I developed also a long time ago called betrayal trauma theory. And the key core insight of betrayal trauma theory is that when people are betrayed by somebody they're dependent upon, that they trust, that they need to continue a relationship with, they are in a particularly terrible bind, because the way we normally respond to betrayal, by normally, I mean in other conditions where we've got some empowerment, we've got some ability to make our own decisions about what should happen, what we do is we confront or we withdraw. So imagine somebody that you're dating or married to kisses somebody else, and you've got an understanding that behavior is not going to happen. In that situation, you might confront the person. You might say, you know, you did this thing, it hurt me, don't ever do it again. Or you might withdraw. You might say, I'm done with this relationship, I'm out of here. The problem with those two responses in a dependency situation, such as, say, a child with a parent, or sometimes an employee with a boss, or even sometimes in a marital situation, when you've got a lot of asymmetry in power and dependency, the person in the dependent position who withdraws or confronts may lose everything. They may actually risk their own survival. And in that situation, there's an advantage to what I call betrayal blindness, not seeing the betrayal, either not even just seeing the actions or not seeing it for what it is, and then preserving the relationship. It allows you to keep in that relationship, which you may need or believe you need for your very existence.
Yeah, that's a very powerful thing. And you talk about this blindness, and also in other research, you talk about the not saying. And so your sense of trust is so important that you'll do anything to protect it, including maintaining being ignorant or maintaining a false veneer of ignorance, right?
Yeah, and you know, sometimes it's a lot easier to be ignorant than to pretend to be ignorant, because we're actually kind of designed to take strong action to betrayal, and it's hard to hold it back when you're aware of it. It leaks out. It's a lot of effort to inhibit your response to betrayal. If you're lucky enough to be able to just not see it, that's a lot easier. And so betrayal blindness is actually something kind of clever. And the way I see it, it has a short-run survival advantage. And the problem is it has a long-run cost to you. And it can keep you in an abusive relationship. It can mean that you don't see future betrayals because you've learned to ignore them.
It was interesting. So when I started researching for the podcast, I had been reading a book by Bessel van der Kolk, who I believe is a colleague of yours. And he had this wonderful quote that said, quote, "As long as you keep secrets and suppress information, you are fundamentally at war with yourself." And he goes on to say, "The critical issue is allowing yourself to know what you know. And that takes an enormous amount of courage." Again, it's like this, it's this like willing yourself towards self-knowledge as a way to deal with your trauma. That's nothing I ever even considered in sort of a layman's understanding of this world.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is you need a certain amount of independence and safety for that to be a viable thing to do. Like to be safe to know, you need to be in a safe situation to some extent, because otherwise you're risking the very thing your blindness is there protecting you from.
So that seems like a good segue into the concept of institutional betrayal. The article that you wrote with Carly Pernetsky-Smith starts with the story of a 19-year-old freshman at St. Mary's College by the name of Lizzie Seberg. Can you tell us what happened to her?
She was a person who came from a family that was very connected with Notre Dame University and had a lot of trust and loyalty for that university. And Lizzie, unfortunately, had an experience with a student at Notre Dame that was very damaging to her, a sexual assault. And when she and then her family tried to get some accountability and some justice, they met up against what we call institutional betrayal, where the university didn't meet her needs, didn't prioritize her well-being, and instead essentially appeared to cover up and protect the reputation of the institution. And very sadly, Lizzie went on to commit suicide. And when Carly and I read about the case and looked at what the parents said, it struck us that the parents were describing what we've come to see in our research as the deep harm of institutional betrayal. You may have heard that sometimes people will say, for instance, veterans who were in the military and experienced military sexual trauma, they may say, you know, I went into the military, I wanted to serve my country, but when I was there, I was raped by a commanding officer, and that was really horrible. But what was more horrible was what happened when I tried to address that and when I tried to seek justice. And in these cases, when somebody commits suicide or they say something was more horrible than rape, you really have to stop and ask, you know, what's going on? Because that's a pretty strong thing to say. And what our research has revealed is that, in fact, people can be very, very hurt by the behavior of institutions that they're dependent on, that they trust, when those institutions, in a big way, fail to come through.
Yeah, and I think in this paper as well, or some of the other research, that actually not saying anything might be less psychologically damaging than coming forward and having this institution not support you.
Absolutely. It's a huge risk when people come forward. They might get a good response and their situation might improve, but more often than not, right now, they get a bad response and their situation is severely worsened. So, you know, I think the question is often, why do people come forward, not why do they not? But this is about the world, right? I mean, if we had a world that was doing a better job in responding, then clearly the you know, reasons to come forward would outweigh the reasons not to.
There was a portion in this article that just stopped me in my tracks, and I'm going to read it. Quote, "Even the most extraordinary example of institutional betrayal, genocide, was once a crime without a name until Raphael Lemkin, a Jewish scholar living in Berlin during World War II, coined the term genocide to describe the systematic destruction of Jewish lives and culture he was witnessing during the Holocaust." I mean, for millennia, there's been genocide. I mean, that is the history of wiping out, you know, and that there wasn't even a word for that. And it seems like the ultimate act of not knowing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to me that betrayal is so central to human experience. And if you look at art and literature and you know, dance, and you look at world affairs, it's a theme constantly there. But does it get labeled? Does it get talked about in a more intellectual, explicit way? Often not. In the field of psychology, there's been remarkably little research on betrayal. I mean, it's such a big thing. And so there's almost like this meta not knowing.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know. And it's, I mean, the same thing's true about sexual violence. I mean, now, as a society, we're talking about it a lot. But even 10 and certainly 20 years ago, it was believed to be really rare. And researchers knew that wasn't the case. But it was a taboo topic to talk about. I remember giving presentations back in the 90s and just presenting data on the percentage of people who've been sexually assaulted. And it was like I was violating some terrible social norm to be providing that information.
Oh,
and
yeah. They didn't want to believe it.
That. No, they didn't want to. And it serves this purpose of, first of all, it allows the problem to continue, but it also lets people keep in their comfort zone and not risk getting thrown out of or rejected from situations they're dependent on. I mean, I was a tenured professor, so they couldn't fire me when I started to talk about that stuff. But you know, I think other people in other jobs, if they start to talk about the true rates of sexual assault in the 1990s, their jobs would be at risk.
Yeah, I've been doing a thing where I'm trying to listen to people I don't agree with, like on podcasts and stuff. And there's a I'm not going to name him, but it was just this truly terrible interview with a writer, and they were basically not providing any data, but you know. They were all about the false rape claims, as if that was the majority of the claims. And I'm like, I don't think there's any data to back that up. And they weren't certainly providing it. Yet these are people who talk about needing evidence for everything else. And it feels to me, I mean, especially I think in response to Me Too and some of the other stuff that, you know, I don't think it can fit in their brains. And I think there's such shame associated with it that's what drives people to, you know, deny the facts that are in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, the forces of denial are pretty overpowering and extraordinary, and you're right.
All right, let's talk about courage. That's a better thing. Talk to us about the center. What was the shift that had you move to create a Center for Institutional Courage?
Yeah, well, so I've been studying institutional betrayal, well, betrayal trauma, and then institutional betrayal for a long time. I first started even researching institutional betrayal back around 2010. So I knew from that research how much institutional betrayal was associated with harm and how prevalent it is. When I first started the research, I was blown away by the prevalence I was seeing, even on university campuses. And I don't think the world has to be that way. And so I started to think about what would be an alternative. And the concept of institutional courage came to me because, you know, sometimes people say, why courage? And I would say, because it's really hard to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. The status quo is there because there are forces that keep it there. And especially when you have an oppressive status quo, it is really hard to change it. So it does take courage. But I fully believe we have the capacity to do this. You know, sexual violence is a hard problem to root out. And I should add, institutional betrayal and institutional courage apply to a lot of things besides sexual violence. It's just that's the domain where my research has been what I know the best. But within sexual violence, we know a lot of it occurs in the family, that the place where people sort of learn to become perpetrators typically is in childhood. And it's going to be hard to stop that. It's multi-generational and so on. But institutions are made of grown-ups. They have resources. they're contained, and in some sense they're accessible to us, unlike, say, a nuclear family. So to the extent institutions are amplifying the problem and hurting people, that's something we should be able to fix. And I do think often institutional betrayal occurs despite good intentions, suggesting we just need to structure our institutions differently to guard against this problem, that we didn't, you know, people didn't realize that institutions could evolve in a way that makes them harmful and didn't have a built-in safeguards. But now we know, and so now it behooves us to fix our institutions so we do the good thing. And again, though, it's making change, and then change takes courage.
So let's talk about some of the things that would make up a courageous institution. So one of them is, like, you have cherished the whistleblower. So this is something in the news right now. Politically, they don't seem to be interested in protecting the whistleblower. That whistleblower is getting attacked.
Yes. Yes, I've identified 10 steps that I can think of that mm-hmm. we could apply right now to making changes towards institutional courage. And cherishing the whistleblowers is one of those 10 steps. You know, we have an example where we do it. A couple examples. We pay people in the software industry to find bugs.
Yeah.
What are they doing? They're they're blowing the whistle. They're telling the truth about a problem,
yeah.
And we cherish them. We pay them a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other, you know, industries that have similar kinds of programs. This has not been applied to something like sexual violence, but it absolutely could be. And if you understand that the people that bring problems to light are very, very typically the most loyal, conscientious people, you'll understand they're doing it almost always to help the organization. And they really potentially are helping the organization if they are listened to, because clearly, you know, you find your problems as soon as you can and fix them before they do long-lasting damage. So it's just crazy to, like, you know, shoot the messenger, which is what we keep doing, instead of listening and fixing the underlying problem.
I was not trying to, in my thinking on this conversation, tying a lot of stuff to improv theory, but I'm looking at it now, I'm like, oh, this is completely what we go into companies to make people comfortable with being uncomfortable. And we think about this sort of in an innovation context. But in looking at it in this context, it is sort of getting to your sort of deepest sense of transparency, where you have to sort of teach yourself to be able to hear the hard things. And then also give space where, when people need to say hard things, they can say those hard things safely.
Absolutely. I think one of the things we need to work on is creating more compassion towards people as they're grappling with truths they've not previously grappled with, to give people room to say the wrong thing and to, you know, to learn and figure it out. And I don't find helpful a sort of rapid shaming response to people. I think what's more helpful is to reinforce them, reward their movement towards honesty and accountability.
My favorite thing about your list of 10 is number 10, which is commit resources to steps 1 through 9.
Yeah.
Very nice. Yep. Way to button that up.
Yeah, well, you see it all the time. Organizations say, oh, yeah, we're doing something, and then that's all they're doing is they're saying they're doing it.
Yeah, no resources whatsoever. Okay, in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes-and story, which we ask of every guest, which is a moment in your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you don't just stop at yes, you do a yes-and. But before we do that, I was reading another paper you wrote on the impact of skills training, because we get brought into tons of businesses to do sort of listening training. And you write in this paper, quote, although there is limited empirical research regarding listening skills training, the importance of empathic responding and listening has been implicated in many areas of research. And I realize this, that a lot of times when people have studied, you know, listening, they're actually studying it from the person who's, you know, doing the talking rather than the person who's supposed to be hearing. So I'm just sort of curious, because you looked into this area, what you know about the listening training that's out there.
Yeah, well, this is something where we actually devised an intervention in my lab, and it's a very simple intervention. It's we teach people some skills for being a good listener. These are just, you know, regular people, not necessarily people who've been trained in at all. Mm-hmm. And what the kind of skills we teach are things, verbal things to say, things to not say, body posture.
Sure.
And what we find is that with a pretty small amount of education, people can become better listeners. And I attribute that partly to the ignorance that people entered this into. We don't teach it in school. It's remarkable to me the things we don't teach our kids when I compare to them to the things we do teach our kids. But historically, kids have not learned how to have these difficult conversations and how to respond in a helpful way. We find through our research that it is teachable.
Yeah, so some of the exercises we do is we have an exercise called last word, where before you respond to the person, you have to use the last word they said, so which requires you to listen to the end of a sentence and teaches you that pause can actually be someone, if they're like, oh, you're actually listening to me, that can be actually a very powerful pause in terms of the conversation. And then we you know, the whole idea around yes and is about not saying no and building on conversations. And we did some research with our partners at the University of Chicago around, you know, what's the yes and for when you're in a place where you completely don't agree. And we discovered that we use the words thank you, because we give gratitude and we try to find some point of connection so we can stay inside a difficult conversation. And that's been a really powerful experience in the workshops when people use that to discuss the difficult things going on in their lives.
Yeah, often people kind of mess up, I think, not because they mean any poor intent, but they're managing their own anxiety in these conversations. And if somebody comes up to you and tells you about sexual assault, you know, that produces anxiety in the person hearing it. So some of these skills are to recognize and manage one's own anxiety so as to not do things that end up hurting the other person.
Yeah, right. Okay, do you have a yes and story for us?
I do, but can I make one other point about institutional betrayal?
Absolutely.
So one of the things that I think it's important for people to understand is that humans have a very strong attachment system, and we're sort of programmed to fall in love. And we fall in love with our kids and with our mates, but we also have this ability to fall in love with institutions. And everybody I've ever talked to has at least some institution they love, maybe their country or their school or their church. That love makes us really vulnerable to the harm of betrayal. But the thing I always want to point out to people that they should think about it, because the institutions can't love them back. Another person can love you back. So, you know, when you fall in love with your baby, you know, is your child. Your child will love you dearly. And hopefully if you fall in love with a mate and so on, or best friend. But when you fall in love with your school can't love you back. It doesn't mean it's wrong to love your school. We all do that. But it means that you should be wise about it and be aware, because the school can manipulate you. It can pretend to love you back. And that happens because it's a way to raise money. Mm-hmm. So I just, it's a domain where I think some literacy, where people can just stop and think about, you know, their relationships with institutions and be aware of the fact that the institution is not going to love them.
Oh, well, I mean, that's very powerfully said to someone who works inside a legendary institution, you know? I mean, I think you would imagine, right, any of these sort of, like, renowned arts organizations that people are so proud. The level of pride of being an alum of Second City to join that list with, you know, Bill Murray and Gilda Radner and Tina Fey and all these incredible people. And we see it all the time in terms of the attachments they have to that place. You know, we change the color of the flag outside and we've got, you know, emails from alumni being like, how dare you? I'm like, you don't even work here anymore. I mean, you form this incredible emotional attachment. And I have to always say, it's like Second City is two words that are on a building. You know, I'm here and there's a bunch of other people who are here who are working. So, I mean, is your problem with us or your problem with this idea of what we're, of who you are and who you're attached to?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'm glad you added that. Yes and story. You have one.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm in a point right now of a lot of transition, career transition in my life. And so I've really had to think about how to do that. And it's meant overcoming some, I guess, some blocks and fears. So one particular example occurred just this fall. But let me take you back to last academic year, which was 2018-2019. And I had a lovely fellowship at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. And my fellowship goal was to launch an interdisciplinary project on institutional courage, specifically addressing sexual violence. And I worked on that all year and put together a project team. In early 2019, I announced this project on my website, my personal website, jjfried.com. And in the announcement, I made a kind of bold statement. I said I wanted to someday create an enduring organization called the Center for Institutional Courage. So I had that goal, but I actually really didn't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I kept asking people, but nobody exactly told me. Fast forward to the fall of 2019, I was no longer at the Center for Advanced Study, but I had a project continuing there to some extent, was hanging out at Stanford, and my life was incredibly hectic, going around giving all these talks, having so many things happening. But I kept coming back to this, I want to launch this center, but I don't know how to do it. And somewhere in there, early November, I received an email from someone who was once a stranger to me. And this person, she offered to work for me pro bono to get this organization off the ground. So she had seen my statement as a 501(c) organization. Now, normal me, and to some extent I had this reaction, is I don't even know this person. I don't have time to do this. I don't even have time to answer this email. But I think the timing was right, or her email was right, because what I said to her was, yes, and it took the form of, I said, yes, let's explore this possibility, and know that I can't take too much of my time to do this. Mm-hmm. So she said, sure thing. And a few days later, I was in Baltimore to give a keynote at Johns Hopkins, and she's a DC person, and we agreed we were going to meet. And right away, it was clear we just really clicked. It was like on a lot of levels. And it was one of those kind of holy crap meetings. And it was funny because we were in this bizarre little diner near the Baltimore airport for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And the dream just really took shape. The person I keep mentioning is named Lisa Schiefelbein. And she's now the executive director of the Center for Institutional Courage. And she's become an incredible partner to me in all aspects of the work. But it sort of reminds me of the yes and, because I said yes talking to you about creating this nonprofit, and I can't spend much time on this. But what really actually happened in reality is it's kind of become this all-consuming labor of love for me, and I sort of tease her that she tricked me a little bit, but right now I feel like this is exactly what I should be doing.
Yeah.
It's like the culmination of my life's work, and I really believe that we can fight institutional betrayal and create a better world through institutional courage. So that's my story. I would have said no almost any other point in my life, and somehow, fortunately, I said yes and.
That is the perfect yes and story. Jennifer Fried, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young.
survived 10 million feet.
Survive.